dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few men I have admired more and had the privilege of working more closely with over a long period of time than our guest for this full hour. His name is Dr. Robert Joseph. Bob has been involved in national security affairs for decades. He worked initially, I believe, at NATO. That's where our paths first crossed when I joined the Reagan administration and found him representing the Defense Department's interests at NATO brilliantly. And I was able to lure him back to the Pentagon to work with me on the intermediate range nuclear force deployment and the arms control negotiations that ultimately were very much affecting that deployment, ultimately ended it, as a matter of fact. Bob went on to a series of positions. He became the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the office of the Assistant Secretary of International Security Policy. We worked very closely there for a bit, and then he went on to become a senior member of the National Security Council staff, an undersecretary of state for arms control and public policy and the like. He's an accomplished and highly acclaimed professional with the rank of ambassador due to his time representing our country in something now no longer extant, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the SALT Treaty created Standing Consultative Commission. Mr. Ambassador, what an incredible background you have, and who better than you to talk with us about the INF treaty that President Trump has recently interred and that we're now hearing we need a lot more of arms control. So I want to talk through all of these topics with you, informed by your considerable experience. Thank you very much for giving us a full hour of your time. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Frank, thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate the very kind introduction. Look forward to speaking with you.
Good. Well, it's not so much kind as accurate, and I think important for our audience to understand the conversation we're about to have is really informed by an awful lot of hard experience. And I wanted to start with this whole sort of notion of arms control. Talk us through the proposition that really got started, I guess, back in the 1920s with Kellogg-Briand and the like, that we could safely make agreements with armed adversaries and have reasonable confidence that they would abide by their commitments. Is that a fair characterization of sort of the lineage of this business? And, well, in short, how's it worked out?
Well, Frank, you take us back to, I think, 1927 and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which outlawed war. And I think we know how that turned out. We also had, in that same era, the Washington Naval Treaties, which limited capital tonnage on naval vessels, U.S., Japan, and others. And we know how that turned out. The modern era of arms control really began, I think, under President Johnson and accelerated after that with the proposition that we could focus on primarily nuclear arms. And the U.S. and the Soviet Union at the time engaged in SALT talks and then START talks. And then, of course, that ended in 2010 with the New START agreement signed under the Obama administration. I'd be happy to go into the history of each of those if you like. But let me just say that with regard to New START, I had the opportunity to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee against ratification, because I believed it had a number of fundamental flaws that we saw in earlier agreements as well. Perhaps the most apparent one was that under the New START agreement, the United States would take its nuclear forces down. We would have lower numbers, and Russia would build up. And this was sold as a constraint on both U.S. and Russia, when in fact, it was another form of unilateral disarmament, which I think is something that you see in each of these previous, or at least most of these previous treaties.
But that's really where I want to start, Bob, and I made small technical correction. I believe that John F. Kennedy, with the atmospheric test ban and some of the space control initiatives of the day, were probably preceding Johnson by a little bit. But the point you're making is so valid, and that is that we went into each and every one of these things involving everything from conventional forces to biological weapons, chemical weapons, nuclear testing, space treaties, nuclear forces programs of various kinds, with this expectation that not only would there be real constraints imposed mutually, in some cases bilaterally, in other cases multilaterally, but that they would be honored. And I guess the question that occurs in the context specifically, Bob Joseph, of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the so-called INF agreement that, as I mentioned, President Trump abandoned last week, that it didn't work out in that specific context, but can you think of one in which it really has?
Well, Frank, let me say that you're absolutely right about President Kennedy and the desire to control or limit testing. But I would also point out that President Kennedy made a promise to the American public, and he did this in a speech at American University. And he said that the United States will never be second to any other country. We will be second to none, was his phrase, in terms of our nuclear capability. That promise has long been abandoned. And it's my view that today we have clear inferiority in our nuclear forces, both the theater force capabilities. So the Russians have reported 10-to-1 advantage there, but also in strategic capabilities, where the Russians have been modernizing and expanding their forces very aggressively under arms control regimes. Arms control has played a significant factor in us losing superiority. Other factors are also apparent, particularly after the end of the Cold War and the defeat of the Soviet Union, the demise of the Soviet Union. But arms control has played a factor in that.
Yeah, and whether you call it the anesthetizing effect or whether you call it the phenomenon of unilateral adherence to these accords, it has indeed, I think no question about it, materially contributed to a worsening of our strategic posture, as well as at other levels of warfare. Bob, we're going to drill down in the next segment on this Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving arms control, a topic that is getting fresh, well, consideration, shall we say, in the wake of President Trump's decision to withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, better known as INF. Bob, I'm thrilled to have a chance to talk with you about this because you and I both lived through the negotiation of this treaty as well as the effort to deploy the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, the Pershing II and ground launch cruise missiles that were the focus of these negotiations on the American side. Of course, on the then Soviet Union side, they were the SS-20 missiles. Give us a bit of a flavor, if you would, of the kind of environment we were addressing at the time, the wake of the neutron bomb fiasco, for example, and NATO trying to figure out what to do about these powerful intermediate range but multiple independently targetable SS-20 missiles that the Soviet Union was introducing in some numbers against both our friends and allies and forces in Europe as well as those in the Far East.
Frank, it was the height of the Cold War. In 1976, Soviet Union began to deploy the SS-20 missile, which was revolutionary in a number of ways. It was supposed to be a replacement for the old SS-4s and 5s, which were liquid, they were inaccurate, they were single warhead.
They were fixed.
The SS-20 was mobile, of course. It had greater range, had much greater accuracy. Each of the three warheads had, I believe it was 150 kt yield.
Kiloton.
Yes, kiloton yield. When you think about that, think of Hiroshima being less than one-tenth of that. These were very capable, very threatening, very strategically important to the Soviet desire to split NATO Europe off from the United States. And that was sufficiently motivating for our European allies to come to us, to come to the United States and say that we needed to deploy a nuclear capability in response. And that led to what was called the two-track decision. You'll remember that, Frank, the two-track decision of 1979, one track being arms control, the other track being the deployment of, in our case, it was 108 Pershing II missiles to West Germany and 464 Glicka missiles that would be deployed in four different basing countries, I think Belgium, Italy, Netherlands, and the UK. The SS-20s throughout these years kept multiplying until there were literally hundreds of these missiles deployed. And of course, the Soviet Union wasn't interested in arms control until we deployed our own capability, which is also, I think, a very important lesson for thinking about arms control. It wasn't until we deployed in November of 1983, the first Pershings, that arms control becomes credible. The Soviets at that time walked out of what had been really meaningless discussions up until that point. But then when they understood that the United States, that President Reagan, and that the NATO alliance, and I give our NATO allies a lot of credit for this, that we were serious and that we were moving forward with deployments, would the Soviets come back? And then we began this long set of negotiations that lasted until 1987 and resulted in the 0-0, the elimination of this entire class of missiles.
Okay, hold the thought, because you put a lot on the table there, and I want to just add a little texture from our joint experience in the Pentagon, working for Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, under President Ronald Reagan, of course, Bob. We saw firsthand the campaign that the Soviets ran to intimidate our allies, to try through propaganda and even threats to the governments from, insurrections in the streets of many of these countries, that they were going to do everything possible to prevent the deployment going forward. And you played a quite significant role, as I recall, as did many of our team in the Office of the Secretary of Defense at the point, to ensure that the allies were fully supported, those programs were on track. You mentioned the Pershing II, also just to decrypt the acronym, the GLICM, the ground-launched cruise missiles. This was an unbelievably complicated bit of business because, of course, there were five different basing countries. And each of them had unique requirements. Each of them had different governing coalitions that had to be you know, satisfied that this program was not going to bring down Armageddon upon them immediately and so on. And so you're absolutely right. I think credit is due to those governments for pulling through. But I want to really start by saying President Reagan's fixed commitment to getting this done and help from Margaret Thatcher and the German chancellor was just indispensable to creating conditions under which the arms control track could actually amount to something. And so hats off to many of those involved. And the main thing here is this was one of the great fights of the Cold War, it seems to me, a fortunately non-kinetic fight. But it proved, I believe, the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union, that deployment went forward, that in the course of these negotiations, Mikhail Gorbachev turned up and became the interlocutor to Ronald Reagan and decided that he was going to go along with this so-called zero option. So, Bob, then the end game, I must tell you, I was a bit unhappy about. I felt as though there were serious problems that emerged in the determination of some of the American negotiators, shall we say, to get a deal. I testified against, you mentioned your testimony, I testified against that treaty in the end because it seemed to me, having left government in part over it, that we hadn't gotten the verifiable, clear, clean zero outcome that we had sought, and that it seems to me definitional problems, verification problems have contributed to some of the what came about subsequently, as well as, of course, just the standard Soviet practice and now Russian practice of cheating on their agreements. Give us a sense of how this thing evolved once the deal was done back in 87 by President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, the General Secretary of the Soviet Union.
Sure. Let me say, Frank, that I certainly agree with you in your characterization of the alliance's resolve. I think this was the alliance at its very best. And I think the deployment of INF missiles to Western Europe, along with SDI, because remember, the Strategic Defense Initiative was announced in 1983, March of 1983. I think both of those factors had a profound effect on the end of the Soviet Union and Soviet leaders realizing that they were not going to be able to achieve their goals and that the Soviet system simply couldn't compete. And I think Ronald Reagan deserves credit for both the INF decision in terms of implementation and also the SDI effort, which were profoundly strategic in their importance.
We're going to come back to SDI. That's so essential to understanding how this whole thing played out. You're absolutely right. But Bob, how did the INF situation on the ground sort itself? The SS-20s, both in Europe, they were in the Western parts of the Soviet Union, I should say, aimed at Europe, and those in the Far East aimed at our allies and bases and forces in, you know, Japan and South Korea and so on, were in fact removed, as were all of the Pershing 2s, all of the ground-launched cruise missiles. And then what happened?
The missiles were removed. The missiles were eliminated. And what we had was a verification regime in place, at least for a limited period of time, that did provide, I think, significant assurance that the Soviet Union and then Russia was abiding by the agreement for a time, and I think that's partly sort of due to the circumstances in Russia, the end of the Soviet Union and the inability to devote more resources to these types of capabilities, at least for a time. But let me just move back because, you know, Reagan was committed to both tracks of the two-track decision. He insisted on moving forward with the deployments, and those moved forward on time, despite Soviet efforts to derail it in every one of the basing countries and throughout Europe. Reagan was also committed to the zero option. And getting to zero, to a global zero, was not easy. And there were various efforts, not just on the part of the Soviet Union, but I think even more so on the part of interests here in our own government, read the State Department, to redefine 00. If you'll remember, Frank, there was an effort to say, well, we'll have 00 in Europe, in a sense, abandoning our Asian allies. It was President Reagan who said, no, 00 means 00. And that's what was achieved. And I think that that was a significant achievement. There aren't many arms control outcomes that, you know, that I think are strategically significant in the sense of being in our interest, in our strategic interest. But I think this was one of them.
Yeah. Well, we can discuss this further, Bob, and we'll have to because we're out of time for this block. But let me just say, this was both a high point in the Reagan presidency in terms of clarity of vision and execution. And there were definitely people inside the government who were determined to try to sabotage it. More on this with Dr. Robert Joseph of the National Institute for Public Policy right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Robert Joseph, a man I've had the privilege of working with for decades and admiring greatly throughout. He has been an extraordinarily effective public servant with a degree of knowledge and expertise and clarity of purpose that has earned him the respect, I think it's fair to say, of both his admirers, of whom I am one for sure, and his critics. He is professional in every sense of the word, and it's such a delight to be able to speak with him at length about our shared experiences and those that he has had subsequent to our collaboration in the Defense Department about arms control in practice and the siren song that we're now hearing in the aftermath of the end of the INF treaty, about which we've been speaking, that we need more arms control. And we're going to come to that point in just a moment. But just, Bob, to finish up on the INF business, you've described, I think, very effectively how we got into this treaty, the effort President Reagan made to satisfy Europeans that he was willing to negotiate away forces that both he and they believed were needed, as long as there were threats from the Soviet Union, specifically these SS-20 missiles. He worked tirelessly to get those forces, the Pershing 2s and Glenn-launched cruise missiles, deployed. He went the distance on ensuring that the so-called zero option was put into place universally. That resulted in this deal. That resulted in turn in the removal of our Pershing 2s and Glickums, removal of the SS-20s. And then over time, you suggested the inspection regime ceased to be quite as effective as it previously was. I believe there were also some issues arising from sort of definitions that the Russians exploited. But what did, in the end, do in the INF treaty?
Well, I think what did in the INF treaty is Russia, and Russia reverting to a pattern of behavior. I mentioned that there was a time period in which Russia did observe the INF agreement. But once Russia recovered or began to recover and had more resources to put into defense, it chose to emphasize nuclear, and it built new theater nuclear systems like the Iskander and any number of other capabilities. And this is at the same time that the United States decides to undertake what was called the Presidential Nuclear Initiative. And that was under Bush 41, in which we demobilized and dismantled basically almost our entire theater nuclear capability force. When I first went to Europe in 1982 to take my position at NATO, we had over 7,200 weapons, nuclear weapons in Europe. With the presidential initiatives, that was reduced to a small fraction. Now, President Yeltsin agreed to do the same thing, and he made this so-called political commitment under the Presidential Nuclear Initiative to draw down their theater nuclear forces, but they didn't do that. They simply didn't do it. And that's why, as I mentioned, today Russia has an over 10-to-1 advantage in these capabilities. So Russia begins to deploy more and more capabilities to modernize their capability in the theater, the Iskander being one very capable missile. But then they began to develop INF ranged missiles. And in fact, it was, I believe it's the SSC-8 cruise missile that was tested to a range prohibited by the INF treaty. So from 2008, when that test is detected, until Friday, this last Friday, when the INF treaty went out of existence, the United States made every effort, diplomatic effort, to bring Russia back into compliance. Russia simply would not do that. And the bottom line here is that the Trump administration made the right decision, because it simply makes no sense for a treaty that prohibits two parties from developing capabilities if only one party is observing that. It makes no sense to continue that.
Yeah, it's unilateral disarmament. Hey, Bob, before I let you go to our next topic, which is a new start, I did want to just ask. I was listening to some of the programming the other day on this topic of the withdrawal from the INF treaty, the formal termination of it by the Trump administration. And I heard a prominent former Russian general, now in the commentary business, holding forth about the violations of the INF treaty by the United States. And I don't know whether this was true after I left the Pentagon back in 1988, in your able hands, by the way, but I remember vividly during those days, and I'm pretty sure it's true up to the present moment as well, that there were hosts of lawyers, not just in the Defense Department, but the State Department and elsewhere in the government, and a lot of people who listened very closely to their admonitions, who would tell us if there were anything we were doing that was remotely at odds with our commitments to INF, or for that matter, other arms control commitments. What would you say in response to this claim that, in fact, it wasn't the Russians who were violating the INF treaty, it was the United States?
Well, here again is another longstanding Soviet, now Russian, pattern of behavior. Whenever they're caught cheating on an arms control agreement, their response is to say, no, you're cheating. The United States is cheating. And then they manufacture excuse to justify their accusation. I saw this when I was the commissioner on the Standing Consultative Commission with the ABM Treaty. The Russians were building this, and you'll remember this, Frank, this large radar in the middle of their country.
Krasnoyarsk, right?
Which was clearly an ABM radar. And they simply said, no, it's not an ABM radar. It's a space tracking radar. They defended that position for years, until very close to the fall of the Soviet Union, Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, acknowledged that it was a violation. But this is the same pattern. They simply accuse us, and now they're accusing us of violating the INF treaty, or having violated the INF treaty, by deploying missile defense interceptors in Romania and soon in Poland, with the argument that, well, those could be converted to offensive capabilities. It doesn't pass the lap test. And let me say that the compliance review process continues in the United States, and the standard of evidence was not sort of, you use the word remote, if it could remotely be a violation. It was the theoretical capability violating. In theory, could this violate the treaty? And so, well, Frank, you've got as many scars on your back as I do on mine.
Well, not quite as many. But here's the point, and I think this is so important for our audience. We have tried repeatedly, I would argue exhaustively, to use the process of arms control to prevent bad things from happening in the world. And most often, one of the other parties, if not the party, was, you know, run by the Kremlin, whether it's under the Soviet Union or under Russia today. And the cumulative experience here has been, with very few, if any, exceptions, disastrously bad. So let's pivot to New START.
Just one footnote on that, Frank. I think, you know, the START II treaty was in our interest. Okay, it banned mobile ICBMs, it banned heavy ICBMs, and guess what? Russia rejected it. They didn't ratify it.
Well, the point is, the treaties that have been put into place have had very, very few, I think, successes to show for the effort. And it's, again, no knock on the efforts of good people like yourself and others who worked so tirelessly to try to negotiate better deals. I do have to say, I found, as you've indicated, that frequently we were undermined by people on our own side whose determination to get deals sometimes prompted bad outcomes. But by and large, serious efforts were made. And it's something inherent, I think, in the idea that you're going to treat with, you're going to negotiate, you're going to come to terms with people who have a practice, a track record, a history, it seems, determination to exploit these kinds of agreements to gain advantage over us by cheating or simply out-negotiating us or otherwise exploiting this sort of soporific effect that arms control tends to have. And I do want to just quickly introduce, and we'll jump to the next segment to finish it up, Bob, the other treaty that remains in place at the moment and for not much longer probably, namely this New START agreement. You testified against it, to your credit. I'm sure that wasn't an easy thing to do. But it's clear now, Bob, is it not, that despite this accord with the Russians, we wound up under the Obama administration essentially ceding to them decisive strategic advantages in a number of places, partly because they cheated, partly because we did nothing, partly because of the cumulative effects of this disastrous arms control process. In fact, Bob, let me just ask you to hold your thought on that, because we're right up against the hard stop we have to make. When we come back, Robert Joseph is going to answer this pregnant question about the New START Treaty. Where do we go from here, and how do we defend ourselves against the now fully modernized Soviet-style threat from Russia? Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Dr. Robert Joseph. These days, he is a senior scholar with one of the most outstanding institutions in Washington, D.C. And I say this as a longtime admirer of Keith Payne and Dr. Mark Schneider and others who are part of that team. There are few institutions, if any, in our nation today that do a better job, a more honest job, a more thoughtful and accurate job of characterizing the challenges that we're facing in the nuclear arena especially, than does the NIPP. And that's in no small measure thanks to Bob Joseph's participation there. Bob, let me just ask you to sort of give us a quick assessment of New START in practice and where you think we are now and the prospects that this treaty too is likely to have to be eliminated rather than perpetuate another example of unilateral disarmament by the United States.
Frank, I think I would start with sort of the fundamental flaws of New START. I mentioned one very basic one: Russia goes up, we go down. But also, the New START Treaty does not cover the theater forces, INF forces, and forces of lower range. These are all nuclear-capable forces. And this notion of non-strategic versus strategic is totally artificial. It's totally based on the arms control paradigm from the Cold War. All nuclear weapons are strategic. Just think about that. And when you look at total forces, what has happened with New START, what has happened with the U.S. moving forward with the Presidential Nuclear Initiative that I mentioned, we have lost our parity with the Soviet Union. Forget superiority, which is what Kennedy said that we would have and many other presidents said. The Soviet Union, now Russia, is superior. In part, that is because Russia has cheated on agreements. And in large part, it's also because we have lost our competence, our national competence in the area of nuclear capabilities. We've lost our technical competence. Just think of the status of the lab. Just think about the problems of building a single pit for a nuclear warhead. We've lost our operational competence. Think of all of the problems that we've had with leadership and operationally with our ICBM force, with our bomber force. And we've lost our policy competence. We have relegated nuclear forces to a previous era. We are hopingly and, you know, slowly modernizing our triad, and our strategic capabilities, our submarines, our bombers, and our ICBM force. But, you know, we have truly lost our overall competence in this area, and we need to regain that. I think we're slowly doing that, but we need sort of a national commitment of resources and making this a political priority.
Yeah. Let me just ask you to pause on that point, because this is such a critical insight, Bob Joseph, and few people, I think, have the authority to issue this clarion call that you do. We're dealing with the most important national security capabilities of all. And your indictment of our competency is something that I have to believe most Americans find unbelievable. How could that possibly be? And yet, I think you're absolutely right. If anything, you may be understating the magnitude of the problem. One of the concerns that I've had for years, as you know, Bob, is without nuclear testing, underground, safe, you know, measured, it's a guess how good our technical competency is, how good our operational capabilities may ultimately prove to be, and so on. And I just fear that we've put ourselves in a position, this is another of those anomalies of arms control, as you know so well, Bob, where we have one definition of what nuclear testing is under this so-called Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which the Senate actually rejected, and yet we still are adhering to. And the Russians have another one, according to which they can continue to do certain testing and apparently have, which has contributed to the buildup that you're talking about on their side that's given them a decisive strategic advantage and certainly modern as well as a whole array of new capabilities. And so, Bob, what does that mean in practice for this idea that we'll have to continue New START no matter what? Otherwise, there'll be this dangerous arms race. I mean, this is the ultimate fraud, it seems to me. There is an arms race. One side is racing, is there not?
I think you're absolutely right, Frank. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is an amazing treaty. It's one that prohibits something that it doesn't define. And, you know, we have said, well, zero yield is the standard. And the Russians have said, well, we understand what the U.S. standard is. And the recent statements by the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency strongly suggest that Russia continues to test in a meaningful way to develop their capabilities. In terms of how this is reflected in arms control, I think that's a great example, and it's one that's not limited to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We approach arms control as something that will be in everyone's, every nation's advantage, or it will be good for the international community. When you sit down with the Soviets, now the Russians, They're there to win in the negotiations. They're there to gain unilateral advantage through the negotiations. And I'm sorry, if they succeed, it's shame on us. It means that we are not taking U.S. interests and giving those interests the priority that they deserve. That is, and that's something that you see over the course of decades in arms control negotiations. And as for the arms race, that began a long time ago with Russia and now China. China in the last decade has been expanding and modernizing its nuclear capabilities. That's why when you think about the future of New START, you think about this decision of whether or not to extend New START for another 5 years, you've got to take into account these geostrategic changes as well as the flaws of New START that exist today. And one of those changes is China and China moving forward. Another is Russia and Russia putting more emphasis on nuclear, including revising its doctrine to encompass this notion of escalate to de-escalate, as many call it. It's really escalate to win. The Russians aren't there to de-escalate. They're there to win if there is a conflict, and they're willing to do that with nuclear weapons. They're willing to threaten our allies, which they have done over and over with nuclear attack. The Russians have a much different view of nuclear capabilities and how and arms control.
Well, and just one further data point that people ought to be aware of. Not only have the Chinese been building up their own arsenal aggressively, and it's unclear exactly how extensive that buildup is, but it certainly surpasses, I believe, all of the estimates that we've been hearing about 200 or 300 weapons. I mean, they have 3,000 miles of underground tunnels that are believed to house parts of their nuclear forces, and that means almost certainly many, many, many more weapons out there than we're giving them credit for. But Bob, there have also been these strategic exercises in which Russian and Chinese nuclear elements have been simulating attacks on the United States, as I understand it. So this is a game-changing dynamic, it seems, and it has to be reflected in changes to any pursuit of arms control. Well, I think of them as kind of will of the wisps, does it not?
Well, I think any future agreement, as I said, needs to account for China. And China and Russia are increasing in their strategic relationship, their cooperation, their military exercises, even more, most recently, joint air patrols. That relationship is growing, and that has to be considered in any decision to move forward with New START.
Yeah, it is indeed. Bob Joseph, your insights into these matters and your long service to our country, places like the Defense Department and NATO and the National Security Council, the State Department, the Standing Consultative Commission, are the sorts of things that have given you, I think, a unique authority, as I said earlier, to comment and to critique and to recommend corrective action. And I know, for one, I am personally tremendously appreciative of that cumulative service to our country. Bob Joseph, until the next time, thank you. Come back to us again soon, as will, I hope, the rest of you. Come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.